David Crow, and this is episode 235 of The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. PRN.fm has voicemail. Call 862-800-6805. Leave a message or question for the show, but also your name, and indicate that the question is for The Infectious Myth. If you dial any of these numbers, either of these numbers, long-distance charges may apply. Remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, an important note, I'll send you a little thank you gift, one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I do really love to hear from my listeners. Don't be shy. And as a special reward, the first and best, the best comment that I receive from a listener before Christmas with your address will receive one of my 2020 calendars, also made with my own photographs. You can make a one-time donation to the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, or you can commit to monthly donations at patreon.com or liberapay.com, where we are also Infectious Myth, one word. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, please consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and challenges to others. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. One of the reasons I've been so fascinated by the recent tsunami of transgender issues is because it's caused a different split than the left-right split on social issues we're used to. Originally, so-called progressives or leftists fully supported the right of transgender people, especially transgender women, to be affirmed as the opposite of their biological sex. But as the consequences of this ideology became clear, especially to women's rights and children's health, the consensus started to shatter. And now we see some on the left jumping ship and allying themselves with groups that only a few years ago they would have been horrified to be associated with. This is actually a good thing. We should not join a political team and support everything without thinking. We should take positions on important issues individually after personally considering both sides of the argument. Recently, a progressive person who lives not far from me saw a posting on Twitter from me on transgender issues and asked why I was so disgustingly transphobic. I replied that he might not realize it, but his affirmation was resulting in healthy girls being encouraged to remove their breasts and healthy boys their testicles, that puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones caused devastating health consequences, as did transgender surgeries. It cannot, in any case, create opposite-sex genitalia. And I invited him to sit down for a coffee or beer.
The Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms, JCCF, is a conservative, nonprofit.
So to even consider the other side's arguments or to even be associated with
it is
gross.
Allied with radical feminists,
this is sad,
concerning
and ideologues on both the left
JCCF
and the right
JCCF provided legal representation
well,
to Vancouver
let's listen to today's interview.
Who refused
afterwards.
To provide a Brazilian
let
wax
know
to
think.
Male-bodied Jonathan or Jessica Yaniv. I have with me today lawyers Jay Cameron and Lisa Billy, who have been involved in some of these cases. Jay Cameron is the litigation manager at JCCF. He graduated from law school in 2007 and articled at a law firm in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. After being called to the bar in 2008, he worked as a Crown prosecutor where he ran trials and bail hearings. In 2012, he returned to Alberta and civil litigation and has since appeared at every level of court in several provinces and the Supreme Court of Canada. He believes in the importance of constitutionalism and the rule of law to national success. He believes that everyone is created equal by God and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Lisa Bildy graduated from Western Law School in 1993 and was called to the Ontario Bar in 1995. She practiced for 7 years with a small litigation firm, doing a lot of trial work, especially in the areas of family and personal injury law. She left her practice for a while to focus on raising and homeschooling her two children, but stayed connected with the law by doing legal research and writing. In 2017, she was gearing up for a return to practice when she heard of the Law Society of Ontario's new requirement that lawyers sign a statement of principles undertaking to promote equity, diversity, and inclusion in all aspects of their lives as a condition of practicing law. Recognizing this as an affront to freedom of conscience, belief, and expression, she led a successful campaign known as Stop SOP to elect to the Law Society a slate of lawyers who were committed to repealing this requirement. She joined the JCCF in August 2019. She also has a private litigation practice in London, Ontario, known as Libertas Law. And the website for this organization is jccf.ca. Welcome to the show, Jay and Lisa.
Thanks for having us, David.
Yes. So was my description of JCCF as a conservative legal organization accurate?
The Justice Center is nonpartisan. And so we represent people on both sides of the political spectrum, both left and right. And of course, it's non-religious, nonpartisan, accepts no government funding. So I would say it's more of a libertarian organization.
So libertarian in the sense of promoting individual freedoms.
That's correct.
And when was the organization founded, and like what was the core idea at that time?
It was founded 11 years ago by John Carpe. And the aim of the organization at the time, and as it has remained, is that it will exist to protect Section 2 and Section 7 and Section 15 rights under the Charter against government infringement.
And can you briefly summarize what 2, 7, and 15 are?
Sure. So Section 2 of the Charter talks about fundamental freedoms, and those are fundamental freedoms vis-a-vis government action or statutory delegate government action, government-controlled bodies. And they deal with freedom of religion, freedom of conscience. Section 2B is freedom of expression, thought, belief, opinion. Section 2D, which we litigate quite a bit, is freedom of association. I should also note that freedom of the press is encapsulated in Section 2B as well.
Okay. And 7 and 15?
Section 7 deals with security of the person, and so that's that provision specifically has been front and center in a number of different pieces of litigation over parental rights and the rights of parents vis-a-vis government education in public schools and where the line is between what the government wants to promote ideologically and where the rights of parents you know, because there's overlap between those rights. Mm-hmm. And Section 15 is equality rights. And so you have equality before the law and that the government cannot discriminate against people based on a variety of different factors, such as race, sex, religion, sexual orientation has been read in by the Supreme Court of Canada.
Right.
Those types of things.
And I mean, it's good that you brought up the idea of conflicts of rights, because that's certainly what the Yaniv case was about. So for listeners who don't know, I'll just summarize my understanding, and you can correct me if you have other things. But Jonathan Yaniv started to transition to Jessica Yaniv, claimed that they were a transgender woman. And they contacted a number of estheticians in Vancouver and requested a Brazilian wax, which is the removal of all the pubic hair on a female. I don't know if all the women refused to take this, but their concerns were being alone with a male and not having the training to shave completely different genital areas and other things. So with that background, like, what did you see as the fundamental principles that were involved in the Yaniv case that made you want to get involved?
Well, I think there's a number of factors which are really unique and haven't been litigated before in Canada. First of all, these female estheticians who work out of their own home, they're uniquely vulnerable. They're not looking for trouble. They're attempting to supplement their family income by providing a service to women. And they do other services like eyebrows and, fingernails and
You don't sound like you're too familiar with all of these things, being a male.
Right. No, I mean, the case, you know, I'm intimately familiar with Brazilian waxes now because of the case. But yes. The women, they're just minding their own business, but they're vulnerable. They work out of their own homes. They have small children present. And so to have somebody who comes off the street and comes into their personal residence and who is physiologically male, it presents a risk to them. And then there's the angle of training because it's a specialized service. And there's a different technique involved with waxing female genitals as opposed to male genitals. And so that's a wrinkle. But the big wrinkle, David, is that self-ID is a big thing these days in Canadian society. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the premise of the Yaniv case from Yaniv's perspective is like this. Basically, I was born with a penis, but now I self-ID as a woman. Therefore, my formerly male parts are now female parts. If you are a service provider for female parts, you must also agree that my male parts are really female parts, or else I will sue you. And so that's the real issue in this litigation.
I mean, another way to look at it from the way that it was initially looked at by a lot of people is to say, okay, here you have some relatively low-income women. I think they were almost all recent immigrants. They didn't have a lot of education. They sometimes didn't have a lot of English language skills. And here you have a white person demanding something from them that they're very uncomfortable with. So there's a racial angle to this. I mean, particularly because Yaniv has made racist statements in the past. But so you would have thought that progressives would have said, wait a minute, this is wrong on the basis that you got poor immigrant women. But did anybody else come out of the woodwork to support you legally?
No, there wasn't, especially in the early days, there wasn't much support from either the media or other constitutional organizations, just because of the nuclear nature of self-ID issues in Canadian society right now. So, I mean, we actually had one of our clients went to 26 different lawyers and couldn't get a lawyer because nobody wanted to represent her against a charge of transphobia. And right, that she had discriminated on the basis of gender identity or gender expression. And so, I mean, that's an issue as well.
Did you reach out to these women or did they eventually find you?
The first woman reached out to us. And so she contacted us because she had a trial pending at the Human Rights Tribunal and she had no legal counsel and she didn't know what to do. And then, by process of talking to her, she let us know that there were others. And it turned out there was 15 or 16 different women who had had this particular complaint made against them. And so we made efforts to attempt to make contact with some of the other ones, but it was a very difficult process because of the tribunal does not publish the list of pending trials until 3 months before they occur. And, right. And so, you know, we asked the tribunal to provide the other women who had had complaints made against them of this nature that we'd be interested in speaking with them and potentially representing them free of charge. And the tribunal refused to do that. And
I can see that, you know, there's a privacy issue that if you're being taken to a civil liberties organization, but when it comes to providing legal counsel, I mean, surely that's kind of a special case, right? Like a tribunal should make sure that everybody who's in front of it, either on the pro or con side, has adequate legal counsel.
Right, and there is no right to counsel in the human rights world. So when you have a criminal charge against you and you don't have adequate means to hire a defender to represent you, the government will pay for a lawyer to represent you. And, right. But there's nothing like that in this case. And so some of these people were very poor and they were bewildered and very depressed and very afraid. And but yet there was, I mean, there was nobody to help them.
All the progressive organizations that should be helping anytime that a racialized person is being set upon by an abusive white person, you'd think that there would be anti-racist organizations all over this kind of thing.
Yeah, for whatever reason, there was none of that until this case became big international news, certainly for the first year that we were involved. There was no... Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. I mean, some of the people who did speak out strongly in favor of these women and against Yaniv's right to a Brazilian were what are sometimes called gender critical feminists. So people like Megan Murphy were very outspoken and her, I think she misgendered. In other words, she insisted that Yaniv with all male parts was actually a male and got kicked off Twitter for that. I mean, did you sort of see the irony of these women, these feminists who might not see eye to eye with you on a lot of issues coming together on this one issue?
Yeah, this is a very important issue for women. A lot of women keep their heads down about this issue. They don't say anything about it, but they're very concerned because of the intrusion on their space and in their rights. And, you know, those are rights that have been hard won, and they see them being eroded and in some cases, you know, disintegrating altogether over self-ID. And so they're upset about it.
Yeah, well, let's move to Lisa's case, and then maybe we can talk about some of the more general issues as well. So if I understand correctly, Lisa, there was a six-year-old girl, I guess now she's probably seven, who was told that girls don't exist. I still don't quite understand what was said, but can you describe the situation?
Sure. So this was a class of grade one children, and I gather that there was one child that may have been questioning their gender, whatever you know that entails. I think they used the wrong, I don't know, there was something strange, like some Purell bottles that were identified as boy or girl on the desk, and this child, a female, used the boy one and was teased for it. There may have been more to the story than that, but that's what I'm familiar with. In any event, the teacher took it upon herself to explain that, she introduced a video which talked about, it was called He, She, and They, and it talked about the fact that some people are neither boys nor girls, and that if you want to figure out what somebody is, then you can ask them what their pronouns are. There was another occasion where she sort of blurted out, and she now says that she didn't really mean to say this, but she said, there are no such thing as girls and boys. So this was very...
And this is the teacher. The teacher said there's no such thing as girls and boys.
Right, because it's their philosophy now and a policy that they're going to teach gender fluidity, as they call it. So in other words, teaching children that there is a spectrum between boy and girl. And she actually put something up on the board to indicate that as well. And this particular child was asked to identify where on this spectrum she found herself, and she pointed to the furthest extreme being girl, and then was concerned that the teacher had said that there's no such thing as girls and boys. So anyway, she went home to her parents and she was very upset about this, and I guess there'd also been some conversation about the fact that you could change if you were in the wrong body. So we'll find out more as the evidence comes out in the tribunal hearing, but that's the that's what I understand now. The teacher, by the way, these are not part of the core curriculum that they're supposed to be teaching. These are so-called teaching moments where something arises in the classroom and the teacher, you know, just kind of takes the opportunity to teach the children something that she thinks is appropriate in that moment. So
which in principle is fine. I mean, if somebody hurls a racial insult in your class, you might take the time to deal with that situation, right? It's not part of the curriculum.
Of course.
I was reading something a bit more academic, and it was saying that at a young age, and I don't know if it would include grade ones, but I would imagine so, that children are still trying to figure out gender. I mean, when you're born, you have no concept, obviously, of anything. But, you know, children will look at the different clothing that people wear, which is kind of a gender stereotype. But then they gradually become aware that their bodies are different. But, you know, in grade one, you probably haven't figured out, you know, if you were asked, what's the difference between a boy and a girl, you may struggle to come up with a good answer.
Right. And I, you know, and instead of telling the children that girls can be, you know, whatever they want, that there's an expected definition of gender rather than a stereotypical tiny little box for what constitutes girl behavior, you know, that would be, I think, a more acceptable way of teaching this, you know, and maybe, you know, that is part of what they tell the children. When there's gender fluidity, you can sort of find where you fit and be yourself. But I don't, there's becoming a conflation of gender and sex. I mean, really, if you want to get academic about it, the whole definition of gender has been evolving over the last number of decades, right? And continues to change at breakneck pace so that really none of us know what we're talking about half the time.
Exactly.
Well, you know, and there's so much logical, you know, circularity to it all too. In some contexts, this is what we mean. In some contexts, we mean something else. And oftentimes, you know, feminists will have one definition and the trans groups will have another, and they conflict with each other. So, you know, from a legal perspective, you know, I'm not sure that we have really entirely thought through what the consequences of these definitions are. But what I'm seeing more of now is a conflation of sex and gender. And so you're now hearing people say, well, really, sex isn't binary either. Gender is on a spectrum, but so is sex. And you sort of think, well, okay, we're a species that has kind of gotten where we are today after many hundreds of thousands of years because there are binary sex categories, right? This is reproductive sex is a accepted thing, but all of a sudden, that's up for question too.
Well, there seems to be some built-in contradictions. Like, for example, the gender dysphoria is supposed to be the condition where the difference between male and female brains are so different that if you have a female brain and a male body, that this can cause, you know, anything up to you wanting to commit suicide. The difference is so great. And yet you also have this gender fluidity where you have non-binary people who are neither male or female, and there's this idea that there's a continuum. So if there was a continuum between male and female, like, how could you be so upset because, you know, your brain's in one part of the continuum and your body's in another part?
It doesn't make any sense. And then you have a lot of feminists who say, really, there aren't any differences. You know, there's no such thing as this male brain, female brain kind of thing. And then you have the trans group saying, oh, yes, there are, you know, and I have a female brain in my male body, so therefore I'm female. Okay, so then you kind of say, well, you know, if the only categorization of what constitutes male and female is whether you have a male brain or a female brain, you know, those are organs too. Why can't we use the ones we're already familiar with, the reproductive organs, as the distinguishing criteria? But now all of a sudden we're really only allowed to say that gender identity, what you think you are or how you perceive yourself, is the deciding factor in whether you are in fact a man or a woman, right? So
it makes life so much more complicated. Like, I you know, even you go to toilets where we now have you know, biological males insisting that they have the right to use them. I mean, toilets were designed for our organs, right? A urinal doesn't work for a woman, a female, right? But by mixing everything together, then we're losing the customizations we've made in society.
Right.
Go ahead, Lisa.
I was just going to say, and also from a female perspective, you know, having segregated spaces is a safety issue for, for many women feel that's a primary reason for those differences, right? For those different categories and spaces is for their own safety and protection. So.
And health, I was just reading an article about a trans man that's a biological female who is having, I think, kidney problems. And the doctors who obviously buying into this whole gender being more important than sex didn't really know which numbers to use. So in this case, the numbers to be used in a man or a woman are different. But in this case, they were trying to treat this biological female as a man, which was resulting in confusion and possibly incorrect medical treatment.
Well, and we've only just recently, I think, started to realize how dosages and all sorts of things are different in males and females, right? Like that's just not that long ago kind of become a discussion point. And now all of a sudden we're going to blur that distinction again. We just started to realize that we need to look at male and female bodies differently that way.
Yes. Well, if I can go back to the Yaniv case for a minute, Jay, let's go to what was for you good news in that the Human Rights Tribunal ruled in your favor and I think also denied an appeal. So can you describe the end of that case?
Right. So the rights of service providers not to provide a service that they're not trained for, that was upheld. Mm-hmm. But the tribunal also talked about how this is an intimate service. And the expert who testified in the case talked about the specific differences between waxing male genitalia and waxing female genitalia. And they are significant. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it's different anatomy, it's different processes, it's different results. And, you know, the expert talked about how males become sexually aroused when an esthetician handles their penis and testicles for a prolonged period of time, which is necessary to remove hair.
Right.
And so, you know, the tribunal ultimately said, look, this is an intimate service. People shouldn't have to provide intimate services against their will. And so, you know, this is not a complaint that is legitimate. Well, you know, and then there was all the other racial issues as well. So
this reminds me of a rather funny story. A medical couple told me that they had two kids and he was going to have a vasectomy because his wife was a nurse. She said, well, I'll shave you before the vasectomy. And so one thing led to another and they ended up getting pregnant unintentionally. So that was kind of a cute example of what happens when a woman handles male genitalia. No matter what whether you want to call it a female penis or not, I mean, it still biologically has the same reaction to being handled to somebody else.
That's right. And that's the thing about the waxing cases is that physiology comes up in direct conflict with self-ID. Mm-hmm. Once you get to a certain common denominator and you see the difference and the difference is irrefutable. And so, I was pleased that the tribunal drew the line in the sand there on the basis of physiology, because that's reality.
And they also awarded a small amount of money, which may never actually materialize, but they did award a small amount of money to some of the women.
That's correct. So the women that took their matters to a hearing each got $2,000 worth of costs. And we'll see about how difficult that is to collect. So efforts are ongoing.
Yes. I'm thinking that it's not going to be easy, but I hope that it does come through. But I mean, I think the principle is the major thing. How would you like to comment on how long the process took? And just the fact that the Human Rights Tribunal took the case. I mean, did they have to take this case from Yeni?
No, the tribunal can dismiss cases that are frivolous or that are nonsensical or that have no merit. And they have the discretion to do that at the outset. But they decided in these circumstances that, and there's a decision on this, David, that waxing is critical gender affirming care for trans people or for some trans people. And so I think there's a number of problems with that assertion. The foremost being that there's no evidence whatsoever that the majority of the biologically female population waxes their genitals. Mm-hmm. But the other issue is that that particular finding is conspicuously absent in the ultimate decision in this case. So once the evidence was in, once all the testimony had been done, I think that the tribunal recognized that despite what it had seen on the surface regarding critical gender affirming care, that there are other larger rights at play. And I think the last issue is, David, is that, you know, I don't, in a free society, I don't believe that I have a right to have my gender affirmed. I know that I'm male. And if you don't think I'm male, that is irrelevant to me.
Yes. I mean, it's hard for me to get my head around that, but it's like, you know, your sex, right? From a very young age, maybe 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever, you know, it's firm in your mind. And if you're at school and you're being teased and somebody says you're not really a girl, then or you're not really a boy, then you know that they're lying. So, you know, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. There's the innate sense of your sex or gender that is something that children might not be able to express very well, but it's something that they know very well. I mean, I can remember at a very young age, I knew that I was a boy, and, you know, I tended to do different things than the girls, right? And wanted to do different things than the girls. Like, that was all very innate, but it could be very disrupting. But on the other hand, you have children who don't really seem to fit into those, right? You have the tomboy who wants to play soccer with the boys, that kind of stuff. And that can also be, you know, confusing to these people.
You know, it's interesting how we've sort of come to a point where, you know, having a tomboy, for example, is something that is like a, you know, there's a potential that child is in the wrong body. That's what is being taught now. I was a child in the 1970s, and I think we were pretty gender nonconforming back then. I mean, the girls had short hair. We climbed trees in our overalls. There wasn't much pink. And, you know, I don't think anybody really had much question about whether they were a boy or girl. I mean, and you could certainly, you know, you played all together. And I don't think it was these stereotypes they've been gradually developing over time. But certainly, you know, you go back 40, 50 years, nobody was even talking about gender other than as a definitional option instead of the word sex, because we thought that was kind of, you know, risque to say or something. So now it's taken on a life of its own. And now we're telling children that this gender identity concept is something that everybody has. And that's, you know, that's what's actually being taught now to children. For a little while, it was, well, there are some different gender identities, and maybe there's as many as 70 or 100. And now it's everybody has a gender identity. And so if you are, you know, sort of just a regular person who doesn't have any conflict between your sex and how you feel about your sex, I think you might be hard pressed to say what is your gender identity. I mean, it doesn't even feel like a thing, right? But apparently we all have it. And if we all have it, then the argument then in this case with the little girl is, well, if everybody has a gender identity and that's what you're telling us, well, then this little girl's gender identity is as a little girl. So why is her gender identity not to be protected? She said she was a little girl. She identifies strongly as a girl. And then we went and said that she doesn't, that there are no such thing as girls. So her gender identity wasn't being respected. And of course, the school board's position is, well, you know, the Human Rights Code is not meant to protect cisgender children. It's or anyone. It's meant to protect gender nonconforming people.
Yeah, that seems like it may be that they're the majority, but in the case where a quote cisgender person is being bullied by transgender people, and this has happened, then they deserve as much protection as if it was the other way around.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, does the Human Rights Code only apply to people who are in certain categories, or does everybody have the rights protected?
Yes, it's a good question. I also wonder if we're going backwards on women's rights. I mean, I grew up in an era where, you know, people were saying women can do everything. I was in university in the 70s, I guess, and I There was a woman in the geology department who I believe was the first. There were lots of those firsts, right? There were women pilots, and there were women. My sister went into medicine as a minority woman, and now in this period, graduating classes are pretty much 50-50 in medicine and law and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we've come a long way, but the gender ideology seems to be saying, look, if you like, a pink, if you want to have a pink backpack with sprinkles on it, then you must be a female, right? Mm-hmm. And if you want to wear your hair short and wear jeans and climb trees, then you must be a boy. We seem to be going away from saying to women, you know, you can do whatever you want. There's no restrictions.
Right.
Another case that you took is actually quite different to that. Another case that JCCF is involved with. This is more involving religion and spirituality. And if I understand it right, it's a mother who objected to her child being forced to participate in an indigenous spiritual ritual. So can you talk about this case and what the issues were in this case?
Sure. So we wrapped this just last week, and now we're waiting for a decision. But what happened is that a letter went, it was drafted, and it was put on letterhead to parents on September 14, 2015, regarding a future cleansing ceremony, and that was the word that was used, to allow people to learn about First Nations traditions, but also experience the cleansing of energy from other students and cleanse their own spirits and cleanse the negative energy from the classroom and the furniture and allow only good things to happen. And, and this is happening in an elementary school in BC. And so, our client got the letter by chance, actually, because one of the teachers never even sent it home, but she happened to have two children in the school, so she got it from one of them. And she was concerned about it, so she went to school the next day and said, you know, I don't want my kids participating in this. And she was told, well, it already happened. It happened today. And so she had less than 24 hours notice. And she, you know, she sends her kids to a public school on the understanding that there will be secularism in the classroom, that no doctrine, creed, religion will be promoted by the state, that, you know, they're going to learn about reading, writing, and arithmetic and, you know, social studies and history and things like that, but they're not going to be subjected to state religious views or supernatural views or anything like that.
To me, there's a difference between being taught about a culture, about a religion, and actually participating in a ceremony. I mean, do you see that as the split here?
That is the crux of the matter. It's entirely appropriate to teach about culture, to teach about other people, to teach about their traditions and their fashion, their music, their art, their food. But you cannot compel people to participate in a ceremony, and that is what happened in this case, because these kids are 7, 8, 9 years old, and they're being told by the school that you have to participate in this ceremony. We're going to cleanse the classroom that you're sitting in, and you have to sit in your desk, and you're going to experience the cleansing of energy, and only good things will happen, and it'll bring good luck, and
which is fine if you want to. Like I could, as a, I don't see a problem as an optional activity, but I'm thinking, like, a parallel that I came up with was, like, what if a priest came to the school and sprinkled holy water on all the children? Like, surely if you were Muslim or Hindu or, you know, as indigenous, you might say, you know, I don't want this. I'm opposed to that religion. My grandfather left and we haven't gone back, and I don't want anything to do with it, so I don't want to participate in what's obviously a spiritual ceremony.
Exactly.
I think it would be seen quite different if it was a Christian sect doing this. People could see that this was a violation of people's religious freedom.
Yeah, under the charter, you have a right to be free from religion. And you know, the history is full of examples where when the state and religion or spiritual forces combine, the result is inevitably oppression, because those religious forces or spiritual forces, they use the power of government to require compliance or adherence or participation in whatever their particular belief system is. And so the School Act says that school is supposed to be taught strictly on a secular basis. No religion or creed is to be taught. And so it was very surprising to this mother that, you know, that there are prayers being spoken to unseen beings, and we're dealing with spirits and energy in the classroom. And the government defended the whole thing as being nothing more than culture. You know, you're teaching about culture. But of course,
I mean, I guess that's where you need to tease these things apart, because, you know, we in the past, Canadian schools didn't teach enough about Native culture, and part of culture is religion. So, I mean, do you object to students being taught about religion in a kind of an academic way? Like if I, for example, said, you know, we're going to have a course, comparative religions, we're going to talk about, you know, beliefs and ceremonies, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, Native, et cetera, et cetera. Is that a problem in a secular school?
No, it's not. And the mother doesn't object to that, right? She wants her kids to be well-rounded. She wants them to learn about stuff. But when you light that sage and you perform the incantations and you actually engage in the process of cleansing energy from the students and from the classroom, then you're crossing the line between teaching about something and requiring participation in it.
And would you object? Would there be a problem if there were, let's be as equal as possible. So you invite all the religious people in your town, the priest, a Buddhist monk, a Hindu official, a Muslim official, an indigenous person, to invite them all to come in for an optional religious ceremony. Would that be a problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be a problem for a lot of people who, number one, they don't believe in this whole you know, ecumenical movement thing, but you also have people who are atheists, right? There was a case about the Saguenay case, which went to the Supreme Court of Canada in 2015, you know, and that involved an atheist who didn't want to be compelled to participate in a prayer. And you have a right to be an atheist in Canadian society and make your own decisions about the supernatural yourself. One of the examples used in the case, a couple of the examples is, you know, the judge said, well, what about, you know, a school trip to observe a baptism, and would that be a problem? Well, of course, that's very different for a number of reasons, because number one, you're leaving state property. So you require parental consent for a 7-year-old to leave state property anyways. Let's say, hypothetically speaking, you go to observe a baptism. The cleansing in a baptism is happening in the water. None of the students are compelled to get into the water, whereas the students in this case are in the classroom, and the space and energy in that space with them sitting in it is being cleansed in a supernatural fashion, according to the belief of the people who are performing the ceremony. And so it's entirely different.
Right. That makes total sense. I mean, there's a big difference between observing a ceremony and participating in it. I mean, I've been in foreign countries and I've seen other religious ceremonies, which, you know, I had limited understanding of. I was just an observer. I didn't feel like I was participating in the ceremony, and maybe I could be invited to, but that would be my choice, right? I wouldn't have to do that.
Exactly. And choice is a big part of this. And when you're 7 years old, you don't know what your will is on some of these things. You don't understand. Your parents have raised you with a particular set of beliefs, and the school should be honoring those by protecting children from the incursion of, you know, favored or promoted spiritual beliefs. And, you know, I told the court last week that when they're smudging the walls of a school, those are the walls of secularism that are supposed to keep that kind of activity on the outside. And when they smudge the doors, cleanse the doors, those are the doors that those students have to walk through. Mm-hmm. And for some of them, that's a significant problem.
And we can't classify religions as good or bad or innocuous or dangerous. There's lots of people who've had bad experiences with a particular religion, that they've been expelled, they've seen it as a cult, they've left. Mm-hmm. And to them, it can be quite traumatic to be forcibly drawn back into, or to have their children drawn back into something that they left. And that probably occurs with all religions. There are people who just say, I'm done, I'm out of here.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's any different than having a priest come in to do an exorcism in the classroom, and then to have the school defend the exercise as being just a demonstration of an exorcism. It wasn't a real exorcism, right? We're just teaching about exorcisms, right? Which is essentially right. What the defense of the school district is in this case.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy. Another thing in Alberta where your organization is based is the Gay Straight Alliances. And this is another area where at first I was kind of supportive, but the parental notification issue became a big issue, where the progressives are saying, if a child is in a gay straight alliance, we need not or must not notify the parents, whereas other people were saying that the parents must be notified if your child is involved. I mean, have you been involved in this at all?
Yeah, I was the lead lawyer on that case, and it's concluded now, but for our clients, the big crux of the matter there was the parental notification issue. And, mm-hmm. and a big reason that was the case was because the government had not thought through, as is so often the case with government action, they had not thought through the implications of what they were doing. So there were no protections about what kind of materials could be provided to kids, no age restrictions about when they could be seeing particular materials. No restrictions on whether or not they could leave school grounds without parental consent, right? Because if you're depriving parents of the ability to know what's happening with their children, right, does that also extend to, field trips where they're going to different activities and parents aren't being notified? And so, you had resources of a very explicit nature being provided to children of a very young age, and you had, the explicit messaging about either sexuality or self-ID, right, gender identification, to kids who are young and who are also autistic. And that was, in a number of cases, which we put before the court, that was resulting in problems that were observable with students.
I mean, over the past decades, there's been a lot of problems with people in a position of authority, priests, teachers, you name it. Sexually abusing children. And it seems like a gay straight alliance where the parents do not have to be notified is a perfect environment for a predator to thrive. They can bring around them this little group of children who are vulnerable, have a lot of issues, they're questioning their sexuality, and they can see the ones who can be most easily manipulated. I mean, that's just ideal for a predator.
Sure. And that's what people who are doing grooming look for. And let's take it outside the school scenario. Let's say that you're a parent and you've got a couple kids and you take them to martial arts class, and they're out on the mat and they're doing martial arts. And then the teacher says, all right, we're going back into this little room back here for the next half an hour, and moms and dads aren't allowed to come with us. And you're not allowed to to know what happens in it. It's all a big secret. Right. You'd have to be insane as a parent to allow that to happen.
Well, we just went through a big sexual abuse scandal with American gymnastics, right? And I mean, and that wasn't a case where they were just taking advantage of the fact that as children get older in a sport, they spend more time without their parents. That was how those kinds of things happened. But it wasn't specifically set up to separate the children from the parents. But when it happened, some men took advantage of some girls and young women.
Yeah, that's right.
Have you been involved in any cases of sports regarding trans women? Because this is becoming a big issue where more and more biological males are getting into sports and winning, because obviously in many cases they're twice as large as a lot of women, and in many sports that's a decisive advantage. Have you had any requests for cases in that area?
Not yet. But you have to imagine that it's coming, though.
Yes, like every week I just saw the New Zealand handball team has a biological male on the women's team who is a head taller and probably twice the weight of any of the biological females, and the New Zealand team won their game. Not a big surprise. So yeah, I guess it's coming.
Yeah, it's going to be impacting a lot of different areas, and already is. And one of the problems is that by immediately branding anybody who wants to have a conversation about these things as a transphobe, effectively we're shutting down, there's an attempt to shut down legitimately necessary conversation about these things. And, you know, in effect, we have a conflict of rights going on in a lot of situations. The way to resolve that is through discussion and nuance and, you know, coming to the table and just kind of hashing it all out and figuring out, you know, where the bounds of one are and what has to give. And all of that stuff is important and essential, but it's not being allowed to even happen, because the minute you start to question whether male-bodied people should be in women's prisons, for example, you know, that's another huge issue. And sports is one that is going to impact more people because they all watch them. I mean, prisons are kind of one of that's an area where it's kind of hidden off. Most people don't have any exposure to it, don't know what goes on. But, you know, there are real issues with self-identification, and you can't talk about it. And if you do, you know, there have been some really fascinating cases just in the last week we've been hearing about out of the United Kingdom. In one instance, there was a woman who was fired from her job for questioning self-ID and transgenderism. And she had to establish at a tribunal where
there's an employment tribunal, if I think of the same.
But the preliminary issue that they were resolving last week, and there hasn't been a decision on it yet, but was whether her belief in binary biology and that was sort of determinative of whether one was a man or a woman, whether that was a belief that was protected as a valid belief, right? So the gender identity was the reality and sex was the fiction. So it's fascinating how these things are happening. But I mean, she was fired from her job. And then of course the other case coming out of the UK was the one where the a fellow had tweeted something about transgender gender identity or something. He had a limerick, I think, he posted in some other gender critical tweets. And next thing he knows, he has a police officer turning up at his place of work to talk about, you know, what he needed to sort of change his thinking on some things. So that was a fascinating one as well. That was a case that was, there was a judicial review happening. And again, we don't have a decision, but the judge was being asked to whether this sort of fell well below the realm of hate speech, but whether it's something that should have been recorded by the police as a non-crime. Anyway, it's very fascinating. But again, anytime somebody wants to have a conversation about these things, this is what's happening. Police are turning up at your door, or, you know, you're getting fired from your job, or like Megan Murphy has experienced, you know, you get up and talk about these things and you are then facing people trying to shut down the conversation through whether it's mobs or threats or what have you.
Yes. Well, we've been talking for quite a while. I would just like to give you both an opportunity to include one last thought, that something we haven't covered that you think is important in this area?
I think that for me, the issue comes down to the preservation of liberty in a society. And Alexis de Tocqueville talked about the love of liberty and the importance of liberty and how societies founded on the principle of liberty, nevertheless, they begin to corrupt themselves because of what they perceive as, you know, the paramount need to enforce equality as opposed to liberty. And, you know, in a free society, you should be allowed to identify however you want. You should be allowed to be free from state intrusion in the form of religion. And it's the preservation of liberty that generation to generation makes a free country. And so, I mean, our country is grappling with these issues in this generation now, and it remains to be seen how the issue will resolve.
And Lisa?
And just to piggyback on that, I mean, you know, we have grown up in post-World War II Canada, you know, most of us now, in a very free society, or relatively free. And I think that a lot of us have come to take it for granted, and we don't necessarily appreciate that it is something that can be lost very easily. And while we have what seem to be strong institutions out there that, you know, keep our society functional, they're very easily taken over by people who don't view freedom very favorably. And I think that's starting to happen. So it's just really of fundamental importance that we all kind of recognize that to have a good society, a healthy society, we do need to ensure that these fundamental freedoms are protected and respected. And that's what our organization is working hard to protect.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Our pleasure. Thanks, David.
Thank you for listening to episode 235 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount to Infectious Myth on patreon.com or liberapay.com. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.